From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Troy Oppie, filling in for Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. First, though, I need to take a minute to thank our listeners for your patience. It's been quite the last 36 hours or so. We were off the air almost all yesterday after road construction crews working on a road project near Broadway severed a whole bunch of network fiber that included every connection that we need here in our building to be able to broadcast either over the air or stream. Late last night, our engineers, whom I should add have spent the last 3 days traversing mountaintops from Pocatello to Ketchum to Stanley, working on other projects, they got back here to our studio. They were able to get a workaround in place, allowing us to get back on the air over most, but not all, our broadcast signals. Streaming is back online as well, but to quote our chief engineer, Kelsey Black, this morning, we are very much still in Band-Aid land. So, again, thanks for your patience. Now, let's dive into our Friday Reporter Roundtable. Today, our panel includes Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Sadie Dittenberg, reporter with Idaho Ed News, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio, and Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com. Boise Dev's Gretchen Parsons will join us later this hour. Hello, everyone.
Hi, Troy.
Hello, Troy.
Hello.
Appreciate y'all being here on a Friday. Let's start with the Department of Health and Welfare pushing back on the results of a recent audit. Jimmy, what did that audit find, and why is Health and Welfare disputing those findings?
Yeah, so this audit came at the direction of the Joint Finance and Appropriations co-chairs, Senator Scott Groh and Representative Wendy Horman. After earlier this year and last year, they were tipped off that the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare may not have followed state law and direction from the legislature on how to administer this specific grant program that was funded with federal dollars and was aimed at combating pandemic learning loss and sort of not early childhood education, but ages 5 through 13. Mm-hmm. Now, to get kind of in the weeds here, the legislature directed them to only use that money for those ages, people who are between 5 and 13, and only fund programs that address that. However, the previous Attorney General administration, one of their deputy attorneys general advised IDHW that, it's fine to fund programs that are without that age or outside of that age range as long as they also served people who are between 5 and 13. So this audit that's been in the works for a few months came out earlier this week, said that they found $3.8 million roughly of what they viewed as ineligible expenses. And they basically chastised the department for basically implementing procedures that were not up to par. So the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare pushed back a lot against this, saying, we don't agree with anything that you said.
They got different advice before.
They got different advice before from Deputy Attorney General under the Lawrence Wasdin administration. They've been sort of hounded by Raul Labrador's administration since he came in, who reversed that sort of legal advice. And then there's been a whole court battle all over this. The Legislative Services Office, which performed this audit, said it was going to forward the findings of this to the AG. I don't know how this is all going to shake out, but this is what we know at this point.
And just a couple of little caveats or nuances to this. One of the accusations in the audit is that agencies had applied for funding under different names, suggesting some sort of nefariousness going on here. But if you look at the list of the applicants, I think we're all familiar with 4-H programs. There's a 4-H program in CUNA, there's a 4-H program in Bear Lake, there's a 4-H program in Minidoka. Mm-hmm. All these 4-H programs are run under the auspices of the University of Idaho Extension Office. Indeed, the University of Idaho applied for several of these grants under their name, but under the specific 4-H programs. And apparently the audit takes issue with that. And I don't know if that's necessarily a valid concern. One of the applicants is the Idaho Association for the Education of Young Children, which applied for three separate grants totaling $3.5 million each for a total of $10.5 million under the Idaho Association for Education of Young Children. And you may recall 2 years ago in 2021, the Idaho Association for Education of Young Children was the subject of a contentious battle over a $6 million early childhood learning grant, that federal grant that the legislature, the House, specifically the House of Representatives, narrowly rejected that funding, claiming that the Idaho Association for Education of Young Children was some sort of indoctrination camp for young children to teach them to become left-wing activists. So I think that some of this, I don't know the lobbyist who flagged this originally, but I suspect that this this fight is a little bit of an extension of that and maybe taking issue with the fact that the Idaho Association for Education of Young Children received three different grants of $3.5 million each.
And Troy, there are a lot of accusations in this audit. I mean, the auditors say that health and welfare spent too much money, that they overspent their appropriation, that they got the money out too late, that they didn't have proper safeguards to make sure that the applicants were spending money on items that fell under the parameters of the grant. But the big one, Scott talked about it, Jimmy talked about it. The one, if you want to focus on one, it's the question of, did these programs serve kids under the age of five? Because as Scott recounted, there was a big fight over preschool funding during the 2021 legislative session. And this program was approved at the end of the 21 session. It was sort of a way to get something in place for 5 to 13-year-old kids. And talking to Wendy Horman, the co-chair of JFAC this week, she said, look, we put that there for a reason. That was the only way to get something through the legislature, was to put a fence around this program and say it's only going to serve kids over the age of five.
And just a quick point to that. When I covered this story 2 years ago, you know, a lot of this money goes to daycare centers and boys and girls clubs, and where kids from very young to 1 or 2 or 3 years old, all the way up to 13 or 18 years old, attend these programs. And so it's very difficult to separate out, oh, you're 4 years old. I'm sorry, kid, I can't help you. You got to go away. So I think that's part of the difficulty in trying to parse out all the money where it's going. And, you know, it just kind of seems silly that we're fighting about money that's going to help kids who are 1 to 5 years old.
And there are so many different hands in that conversation between the legislature and the Department of Health and Welfare and the Attorney General's office. But the Attorney General's office is in a different legal dispute with a different state agency. Kevin, you laid out the background this week on the AG's lawsuit against the State Board of Education. What's the latest there?
Oh, boy, there's so much going on there. Mm-hmm. The lawsuit kind of came to a head this week, and actually last week as well. The attorney assigned to the case, hired by the State Board of Education to defend the State Board against Attorney General Raul Labrador's office, she filed a quartet of motions, all designed to undercut Labrador's lawsuit. And the big one that came up on Thursday, and I'll defer to Sadie, was there. Jimmy, I know you were covering it. The big one was the question of, can the Attorney General actually sue the State Board? Is he qualified to do that, or is he disqualified himself from filing a lawsuit against the State Board? Does he have a conflict of interest? And more tellingly, and this is really kind of, I think, the blockbuster out of this motion, did he talk to Matt Freeman, the executive director of the State Board of Education? Did he glean information during a phone call with Matt Freeman and then use that information against the State Board as ammunition for the lawsuit? Because if you read the declaration, and I've read a lot of documents this week, what Matt Freeman is saying happened was he was approached about these closed meetings, these executive sessions that are at the heart of the lawsuit. He was asked questions by Labrador and Theo Wald, Labrador's solicitor general. He was asked about the open meeting issues. He was asked about the nature of the negotiations. And he says he did not realize until the end of the conversation, when he was told by Labrador, oh, yeah, we're going to file a lawsuit against y'all about this. So that raises a lot of questions about did Labrador overstep his bounds? Did he act properly in, kind of interviewing, grilling Matt Freeman over these meetings? So that's the thrust of it. Hearing was on Thursday. No decision made. We expect one within a few days. And now I'll shut up and let those who actually covered the hearing talk more about it.
Well, and the crux of this, just to kind of repackage that a little bit, Freeman thinks he's talking to his attorney, right?
He thinks Raul Labrador's state board's attorney. He's asking about this open meeting issue. So yeah, of course I'm going to talk to him. And he says he talked very openly and very candidly.
Right. I mean, was it a deposition or was it a conversation with who you think your lawyer is that is protected through attorney-client privilege?
And that's kind of the point of it. I mean, they're saying, look, if you're talking to an attorney, you kind of like to know in what capacity you're talking to the attorney. Are you, is this attorney-client stuff or is this, part of the discovery process? Big difference.
And Sadie, you were in the courtroom yesterday as well. What's next here? What's the process that this is going to play out in?
Yeah, it sounds like the judge will make a decision within the next week. And other than that, it's just kind of a waiting game from as far as I know. We're waiting for that decision. The state board said that they don't necessarily, at least in this motion, they're not asking for the case to be dropped. They're just asking that the attorney general find outside special counsel to represent the argument instead of Labrador himself.
Yeah, and that's an important point that I can't remember if we touched on in the previous segment about the IDHW lawsuit. An Ada County judge actually said that Labrador, overstepped there and must appoint a special prosecutor because of that conflicting legal advice. And that's essentially what the State Board of Education is asking here as well. There's a deadline for Labrador to appoint a special prosecutor in the IDHW lawsuit. That is Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And we'll get similar news one way or the other on this one soon.
Well, and quickly, there is a concern that, the University of Idaho is concerned that this lawsuit could potentially derail their planned purchase of University of Phoenix, right?
Yes, that's a big thing that came out in the filings. Everything about this purchase is on a pretty tight timetable, including the fact that next week the accreditors for the University of Phoenix are going to be down on that campus doing a site visit. And the accreditors for Phoenix and the accreditors for U of I have to approve this deal in order for it to go forward. And U of I is concerned that if you have this lawsuit hanging overhead, the accreditors are going to balk at acting on this proposal, and it could jeopardize the whole deal because, as we've also learned from these filings, there are supposedly still other states and other universities that are interested in potentially acquiring the University of Phoenix. So, I know there are a lot of people who don't like this deal, mm-hmm. and would probably just as soon see it go away, but this may be a potential snag in this deal going forward.
Yeah. A quick note about our conversation in the previous segment. Do want to mention that the Idaho Association for the Education of Young Children is a Boise State Public Radio underwriter. Caitlin, a bit of a surprise headline from Island Park in East Idaho this week, where a woman fell into the water and contracted a flesh-eating bacteria?
Right. Yeah. Her name is Rochelle Wynn, and she has had quite the month.
Can't imagine.
Yeah. The last week of July, she was on a floating trip down in Big Springs in Island Park when she fell in the water just at a really shallow little area getting out to go back up and float back down. And she cut her knee open on a rock. It was a pretty big gash. She said it was about 3 inches long and 1.5 inches deep. So her friends that she was with called an ambulance for her, and they took her to Madison Memorial Hospital, where they stitched it up for her, gave her some antibiotics, sent her on the way. She had some issues with the pharmacy, wasn't able to get her prescriptions on time, and after about a week noticed that she was in a lot of pain and her skin was like turning black. I mean, if you look at this article, there's a huge editor's note, extremely graphic photos. I can't even explain what they look like really, but basically what happened is she ended up going to IRMAC in Idaho Falls, and she ended up with what they call her shark bite. They had to cut like about 25% of her leg off to get the infection out. She ended up getting necrotizing fasciitis, which is a flesh eating disease, and that progresses pretty rapidly. So she ended up having to get that surgery. She recently had a surgery to put animal cadaver on top of it to kind of revive the healthy tissue in her. And she'll end up having to get a bunch of skin grafts. And I did speak with her doctor, Dr. Olivson at IRMAC. He's the burn director. And he said they actually see this about 3 to 4 times a year, but it's very rarely this bad. So just a reminder out there to know the symptoms of an infection. You know, if your skin is hot and irritated, if you have a fever, definitely time to go get something looked at before it gets any worse.
Well, and it sounds like the unfortunate timing combination of the injury, where it was in the water, the inability to get prescriptions in a timely fashion. But do we know if state officials have investigated that spot where she fell for further contamination, or what they're saying about the safety of that area?
So it sounds like the area isn't exactly what made her sick. It's more of the fact that, you know, natural fresh water can be really dangerous, even if, you know, you're just swimming around in it and having a good time. But according to the doctor I talked about, like, this kind of thing tends to snowball, and it's really just about getting any kind of cut cleaned out as fast as possible, as efficiently as possible. This is something that can happen whether you fall in a puddle on your street or in a river. Like, Dr. Olivson basically said that, you know, it could have been anywhere this could have happened, but places where people tend to be walking around, you know, making the area more dirty, the water is dirtier, can be more, it can cause infections to get worse than they would be if the water was cleaner. But I don't think it has specific, it's not in particularly dirtier as any other water, but Dr. Olivson just really made a point to say, if you get a cut in the water, make sure to clean it out as fast as possible. If you're worried about it, see a doctor, get some antibiotics, but really just keep on track, because these things can spiral like no other.
Don't do what I do. Rub some dirt on it and it'll be fine. Don't do that. Yeah,
pretty much. Yeah, exactly.
Well, we wish her well. In North Idaho this week, the man charged with killing 4 University of Idaho students last year waived his right to a speedy trial. Scott, you wrote in a column this week that delaying the trial of Brian Koberger that was previously set for this October is the right move. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, and this is probably not too much of a surprise, but it's significant because the judge in the case had originally set a trial date of October 2nd, and really that's required under our constitution for the right to a speedy trial. Mm-hmm. And unless the defendant waives that right to a speedy trial, the judge has to schedule, give that trial, start a date. And because of that, there was a really aggressive timeline. You know, the prosecution and the public defense had just a couple of weeks to finish the discovery process. They had another week after that to name all of the experts that they plan to have testify. They had to identify all of their witnesses by the middle of next month. All motions were to have been filed by September 22nd, and jury selection was going to start on September 25th. That is just 1 month from today. Mm-hmm. And this is obviously a sensitive case, a complicated case. This is a quadruple homicide. This is a death penalty case. Mm-hmm. And to get all of that done in that short amount of time was really going to be difficult and fraught with danger of mistakes or errors. And the family, we sympathize with the families of the victims who want quick resolution. They wanted this trial to start sooner rather than later. And they had posted on Facebook before the hearing that they were afraid that this was going to happen. They didn't want this to drag on for years. But really, in a case like this, where it's so complicated and sensitive and involves a death penalty, number one, it's going to go on for years regardless, because it's a death penalty case. And second, if there are any errors or mistakes or things left out because it's hastened, then that's going to delay justice even further. So it may be frustrating right now that the trial isn't going to be happening right away, but in the long run, it's probably going to serve justice better to wait and do it right from the beginning.
And there is no date now for when the trial may start. Some of that might be announced at least next month, but Koberger's defense is also working on a challenge to the grand jury testimony and process that indicted him in the first place. That's been filed now, correct?
Right, right. That further delays the process. And right, like you said, we haven't heard a new date yet or a new schedule, but that'll be the next thing we hear from the judges is what that new schedule will be.
Kevin, the state's Empowering Parents program is being hailed as a success. These are the microgrants that families can apply for to use for education-related spending, $1,000 per child up to $3,000 per family, and the distributions prioritized by household income. The current grants have all been awarded. A lot of the spending is ongoing. And there have been some questions about the guardrails for appropriate spending within this program. How is the State Board of Education measuring the success now of Empowering Parents, and where are some of those audits that remain in progress?
Well, the State Board of Education had a discussion of Empowering Parents. They got an update on Empowering Parents on Wednesday, and I was struck by the tone of the update and kind of the tone of board members and board staff. They believe they have figured out how to get this program working better going forward. They feel like they're in a better place. It's been well documented. We've written a lot about the problems that have come up with this program. Money that was spent on TVs and smartwatches and cameras and things that were not items that are supposed to, that parents are supposed to buy to help their kids learn at home. So they're saying that they feel like they have better safeguards in place. They're going to be much more careful now about looking at purchases on the front end and looking at them after the fact to make sure that they're appropriate. You did mention an audit. Governor Brad Little asked for an audit. It looks like that may be in the works in the next few months, possibly coming out later this year. What's interesting to me about this, too, and we talked in the first segment about the child care grants and the flap over those grants and the audit that came out this week. Mm-hmm. One common thread among several between these two programs is they were both funded through federal coronavirus aid. And in both cases, I think you had state agencies that really wanted to roll the money out, get money into the hands of parents to help their kids get through the pandemic, whether it's helping them buy a laptop or get better internet access or helping them get aligned with a child care program. I think in both cases, you've got agencies that moved quickly with noble intention. You're in the middle of a pandemic. You got kids who are needing help. But you had two programs where there maybe not a lot of safeguards in place. Certainly there were glitches in Empowering Parents. That's been pretty well documented, and it's not really much in dispute that things did not go as smoothly as the state would have hoped the first time around. And why does this matter? We're going to have another round of these grants available in the fall, $30 million of state money this time. So it's important to watch now to see, did the state board get this thing right the second time around? Do they have a better system in place? We'll be watching it closely.
Sadie, students at Pocatello's Highland High School were back in classrooms this week. It's just 4 months after a fire destroyed most of the building's gym, cafeteria, the music facilities. There was water and smoke damage in many other areas of the school. How much space were they able to salvage, and how are they making do now in the new school year?
Yeah, so I traveled to Pocatello on Wednesday for their first day of school to kind of get those answers. And their solution, as of right now, they can't use the small gym. There's some fire damage and some flooring that needs to be repaired. And then the part that was damaged, the gymnasium, cafeteria, music rooms, has been completely demolished at this point. There's no structure left. And so to kind of to solve their spacing problems, they're using other facilities in the community, like the Calvary Chapel, which is just down the hill from the school, an auxiliary building that they would usually use for professional development for teachers, that is just behind the school. And so they've spread out their campus a little bit. So that chapel is being used for the band, orchestra, choir classes. The auxiliary building is being used for meal preparation. The cafeteria workers prepare meals there, and then they have a little truck that they haul the food into and then drive it over to the school. And then also in that auxiliary building are the health classes. So they have a yoga class and weight classes, exercise classes, things like that. Those are being held in that building. And then the cafeteria now is in the foyer of the school. So they removed lockers from that inside area and replaced them with lunch tables. And hold on, sorry, let me turn my do not disturb off. They replaced them with lunch tables. And so that's where students eat. It gets a little bit congested, but the district said they're pretty confident that students will find a way to navigate those halls, either avoid that congestion during lunchtime or just go off campus for food.
And I got a sense from your story that there's a very strong sense of pride and resiliency from both the student body and from the staff in that building as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking to staff, they were saying just between everything that's happened within the past few years with COVID and the fire and everything, they are very, very resilient, and they're pretty confident that they'll get through this tough time. And when the fire initially happened, the classes moved over to Century High School. And so a lot of the teachers were saying that they're thankful that they're not in Century High School anymore, because it was a pretty cramped space. Mm-hmm. And the students are happy to be back in their own school. And there was a pep rally that they held on Wednesday, and it was very loud. You could hear students' voices echoing through the hills and the valley and everything. Mm-hmm. So it was a really powerful day to be there reporting on that. And there's lots of student pride and staff pride, and it was really cool to see them.
And quickly, do we know what's next for Highland? I've read that the school board is considering a bond, perhaps.
Yes, they approved a bond. A couple weeks ago, maybe last week, they approved a bond issue that would repair Highland. So it would build onto the facility, expand the facility. It would also expand the gym at Century High School. And it's estimated to be about $42 million, but they haven't set an exact price for it. They're still working out that language. And the board approved that in a 3-2 vote over another option, which was to just build an entirely new facility. And that was projected to be about $115 million. So they chose the $42 million one.
Let's stay in East Idaho. Caitlin, an auto shop owner, is not only going to have to pay a massive fine, but also faces jail time for selling and installing emission control bypass devices for customers. This sounds like a massive operation that was based out of a Rexburg auto shop.
Right. So we got a news release from the U.S. Attorney's Office this week saying that the diesel performance parts retailer GDP Tuning and Custom Auto of Rexburg, doing business as Gorilla Performance, basically pleaded guilty to criminal charges on Wednesday in federal court and agreed to pay $1 million in criminal fines and implement compliance programs, as well as not manufacture, sell, or install any devices that basically defeats a vehicle's emission controls. So essentially what was happening is GDP Tuning conspired with the owner to violate the CAA by purchasing and selling a bunch of these tuning devices that tampers with the vehicle's onboard diagnostic systems, which basically makes the vehicle emissions control equipment malfunction and not illuminate the vehicle's check engine light, as far as I understand it. But it's a pretty big deal. They're scheduled to be sentenced by District Court Judge Lynn Windmill in November.
I want to turn now to the State Board of Education this week. It's a very busy week for the State Board of Ed. They moved forward with a policy banning the use of diversity statements as part of the hiring process for higher education jobs. Jimmy, you covered this for us. What are these statements, and why has the board taken this step?
Man, it really has been Education Week here, hasn't it?
It has, yeah.
So this is a policy that's been in the works since April, when state board members directed staff to draft it. So we got our first look at this, And basically what it's saying is any college or university within Idaho, at least public college or university, cannot require as a condition of hiring someone that they, with their job application, produce some sort of diversity essay or statements. So basically what was happening was applicants would be asked, you know, how familiar are you with diversity, equity, and inclusion policies or principles, and how would you apply them through your role should you be hired? You know, this has been sort of a hot topic, controversial sort of issue throughout the country, really, with, you know, conservatives saying that this is just another part of the woke ideology that's permeating, you know, American culture. Some faculty and staff at colleges and universities across the country are also saying that it's, you know, possibly violating First Amendment rights. Mm. And so, you know, the State Board of Education just didn't want to deal with that. And so they specifically, through this policy, would ban their mandatory use. That's not saying that, you know, an interviewer can, can't ask an applicant, like, you know, what's your familiarity with these topics and things like that. But you just can't mandate that they write this little essay for you. So this was given a first approval, first reading, and the State Board of Education will still have to give final approval. When that is, we don't know. But, you know, it was unanimous on both votes to draft the policy and then also approve this first one. So it doesn't seem like there's much resistance. Mm.
And that item was one of many on the State Board of Education's agenda at their fall meeting this week. Kevin, what other highlights came out of that meeting for you?
Well, something I think of interest in here in Boise is the board approved plans that will allow Boise State University and the city of Boise to work on the Lusk neighborhood. And that's a neighborhood west of campus. It's pretty heavily used right now by students for off-campus housing. This plan would ultimately, the university is hoping, would add more housing units off-campus, immediately off-campus. Kind of an interesting sidelight, and that's just one of these quirky things that come up in meetings sometimes. The State Board unanimously approved a lease agreement between the University of Idaho and Home Depot. Now, this is not as big a deal as Phoenix, the University of Phoenix purchase, but it is an interesting one. The U of I is going to lease some property near the Palouse Mall, near some commercial that's been used as pasture land and cropland. They were going to lease it to Home Depot so Home Depot can set up a retail center in Moscow. This has actually generated quite a bit of opposition in the Moscow area. But the State Board approved it unanimously. So, just an interesting sidelight. And part of the debate was, well, this is going to generate some revenue for the University of Idaho, probably upwards of $100,000 a year almost in the beginning, and the lease payments go up over time. So the argument was, well, should the U of I capitalize on this? Saying no to this lease agreement doesn't necessarily keep Home Depot from coming into the Palouse. So interesting little debate there.
Gretchen, joining us now, you're the managing editor at Boise Dev. You followed a lot of coming and goings this week on the local restaurant scene, including one in downtown Boise that's had a lot of people asking, what's next for the spot where Even Stevens Sandwiches was? They've been closed for a while. There was an eviction notice posted on the door, but it sounds like the vacancy is soon to be ended.
Yeah, that's right. So there's now signs in the window that advertise Nara Ramen. And I spoke with a Nara employee, and she says this downtown location, it's going to open in about 6 months. They have to do some remodeling inside to convert whatever was in Even Stevens to make it into Nara Ramen. Nara, they recently opened a location in Bound Crossing. There's also one on State Street and another on somewhere by the Boise Mall. So this will be their fourth location in the Boise area. They also have one in Twin Falls, but they've really been rapidly expanding. If you haven't been there, they have over a dozen different ramen choices on their menu. They also have some other appetizers and things. But so that should open in about 6 months. And if you're unfamiliar with that location, it's on Bannock Street. It's right across from 10 Barrel. Or
10 Barrel, yeah, right there.
Yeah. Yeah, so that should be opening in 6 months.
The ramen folks are certainly confident that people are enjoying their slurping, opening four locations now. Wine enthusiasts are getting a new downtown spot to imbibe, but also learn about wine as well. What's that about?
Yes, that's right. Good news for people who like wine, myself included. this place, it's called House of Wine. It's going to open on at a storefront in downtown Boise on Main Street. And so basically it's a wine education company. And the lady who founded it, she teaches the classes. She's also the owner of this new storefront. Her name's Catherine McClaskey. And House of Wine, they offer education courses for people who just want to learn more about wine and appreciate it. Also for people who maybe work in the restaurant industry and want to know more about what they're serving. So really the classes, they're open to anyone. But the space on Main Street, part of the shop will feature like a classroom / tasting room where they will, you know, teach courses out of. And then also the other part of the store will be a retail shop. So you can also just swing in there if you want to grab a bottle of wine. They're going to have a pretty good selection. And let's see, that will open in November, not an exact date, but that'll open on Main Street in a few months here.
Very good, Gretchen. Thank you. Sadie, you reported on the Boise School Board. It has an open seat on the Board of Trustees, and they have narrowed their candidate options. Now, how many people applied and who has been interviewed or being interviewed as finalists?
So the school board received 9 applications, and they recently narrowed it down to 4. So we have Darla Mitchell. She is a director of strategic markets at Kindrel Incorporated. She's a Girl Scouts leader in Boise, and she's concerned about equitable access to education in the Boise district. We have Jennifer Pierce. She's a geosciences professor at Boise State. She has kids in the district and has volunteered in the district before. There's Kenneth Howell. He's a lawyer for Holly Troxel, and he serves on boards for different organizations throughout the Treasure Valley, College of Idaho Board, Idaho Public Television, Downtown Boise Association. And then there's Paul Bennion. He is the Vice President of Student Affairs and the Dean of Students of the College of Idaho, and he's also been involved with the Boise District. So those are the 4 applicants that they've narrowed down. They are going to hold interviews with these 4 applicants, I think, on August 29th. And I believe those are going to be public meetings. And then they should have a decision on their choice by the September board meeting. And in that meeting where they chose, where they narrowed down the applicants, there was some concerns from board members about allowing some of the applicants with agendas, very clear agendas on their applications onto the board. So that definitely factored into their decision-making process. And they wanted somebody who can have a long-term commitment to the board, who would be able to run a campaign and doesn't just want a one-time appointment. And then just looking at all of the ways in which these applicants are involved in the district, have connections throughout the community and things like that.
And this is the board seat previously held by Andy Hawes, who moved out of state. Remind me how long the remainder of his term was and how long this appointee would serve.
I'm actually not sure.
Oh, sorry. I put you on the spot there because I didn't know it either.
I can't remember.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to you. But before we go, Scott, I wanted to check in with you because you and several colleagues reported this week on new resources in the Treasure Valley meant to help kids that might need extra support for emotional or behavioral concerns. Tell us more about these new resources.
Yeah, we were kind of each doing our own thing. And then we realized, wow, this is really a big deal. There's a bunch of new programs. I'm going to start with the Idaho Youth Center or the Idaho Youth Ranch, really big deal. This is a huge deal for the state of Idaho. This is going to be the first time in a long time that there is going to be residential services for youth with mental health issues. And so this is a 258-acre Hands of Promise campus out in rural Canyon County near Caldwell. And, you know, saying near Caldwell is a stretch because it's really out in the middle of nowhere. I went out for the grand opening for this. And it's really impressive. It's got dormitories for students. It's got a charter school on site, a rec center, a gym, a welcome center, a cafeteria. It's just a really great addition and necessary for the state of Idaho so that we don't send kids out of state for mental health services, for residential mental health services. The other one I'll plug is the CUNA Boys and Girls Club. This is something that I've been writing about since 2006. And it's finally coming to fruition. They received another donation from the MJ Murdoch Charitable Trust last week for $375,000. That brings them up to $9.1 million to build a Boys and Girls Club in CUNA, which they've been talking about for the last 17 years. And so that is going to be a great addition. They're still, you know, they're confident they're going to get to the $11 million goal and have an opening next year. And then the third thing is the Bridge Youth and Family Resource Center that provides a single point of contact to deflect youth from the juvenile justice and child welfare systems. It's a preventative program to get services to families and children in need. And that is through Ada County. The Governor Brad Little and the Ada County commissioners helped make this happen in Boise.
Sadie, I don't know if you were able to dig up that answer to the question I put you on the spot for. Before we go, do we know how long the appointee to the Boise School Board would serve?
He was elected to a 4-year term, it looks like, in 2022. So then that would leave, what is that?
I'd leave another couple of years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, I put you on the spot and you delivered. Thank you for that. Thank you to all our guests today on the Friday Reporter Roundtable, Kevin Richards and Sadie Dittenber with Idaho Ed News, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Gretchen Parsons, managing editor with Boise Dev, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio. I'm Troy Oppie filling in for Gemma Gaudette. She's back next week. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Want to learn how to be a master of business without going back to school? Listen to the Planet Money MBA. No suits, no PowerPoints, just the secrets of business school delivered straight to your ears. Every Wednesday till Labor Day on Planet Money from NPR.